translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada Ki. With sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work, karma, by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, who will not pay attention to His message? Purport. The contact of the spiritual spark with the material elements creates a knot which must be cut if one wants to be liberated from the actions and reactions of fruitive work. Liberation means freedom from the cycle of reactionary work. This liberation automatically follows for one who constantly remembers the transcendental pastimes of the personality of Godhead. This is because all the activities of the Supreme Lord, His Leela, are transcendental to the modes of the material energy. They are all attractive spiritual activities, and therefore constant association with the spiritual activities of the Supreme Lord gradually spiritualizes the conditioned soul and ultimately severs the knot of material bondage. Liberation from material bondage is, therefore, a byproduct of devotional service. Attainment of spiritual knowledge is not sufficient to ensure liberation. Such knowledge must be overcoated with devotional service so that ultimately the devotional service alone predominates. Then liberation is made possible. Even the reactionary work of the fruitive worker can lead one to liberation when it is overcoated with devotional service. Karma, overcoated with devotional service, is called karma yoga. Similarly, empirical knowledge, overcoated with devotional service, is called jnana yoga. But pure bhakti yoga is independent of such karma and jnana because it alone can not only endow one with liberation from conditional life, but also award one the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Therefore, any sensible man who is above the average man with a poor fund of knowledge must constantly remember the personality of Godhead by hearing about Him, glorifying Him, by remembering Him, and by worshipping Him always, without cessation. That's the perfect way of devotional service. The Goswamis of Vrindavan, who were authorized by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to preach the bhakti cult, rigidly followed this rule and made immense literatures of transcendental science for our benefit. They have chalked out ways for all classes of men in terms of the different castes and orders of life in pursuance of the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam and similar other authoritative scriptures. Om Agyana Chimirandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Miditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stabitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vanchita Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Paditanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, from the top, first canto, right? First canto actually is, we could call, preliminary canto. It deals with what are we doing, what's the duty of man, why are we even reading this scripture? Because what is Bhagavatam? Is it spoken to the sages in Naimisharanya, like we're dealing with here, or is it spoken to Parikit Maharaj, right? No, but it's both. Bhagavatam is not actually the book. Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of the Lord. So it's an eternal thing. It doesn't function. We have a material mind, so we tend to put everything into time and space because that's the framework of our material mind. But actually, it's transcendental, so that means it's always existing in some form. It's explained how for the demigods, the Bhagavatam has like a million verses because there are more details to take care of. They're dealing with how the whole universe is managed, so they need more knowledge. We don't. We're sitting here in Kali Yuga, so we need the basics. So we got a few thousand verses to deal with. That's basically, and we get confused by that. So this is like the basic. But so the point being that the Bhagavatam, in a sense, this first canto is preliminary. It's not actually the Bhagavatam. We're just dealing with why are we actually approaching the Bhagavatam. Right? We see that it's actually the Mahabharata in Bhagavatam form, right? Krishna is winding up his pastimes. Kali Yuga is starting. Why do we have it in text form? Because it's Kali Yuga. Other yugas, you didn't need it written down because people knew it. It was just the way to live. Even the asuras were following the Vedic principles because they're intelligent, it's like it's saying here, intelligent men. They know that this is just how it works. It's just how things work. But in the Kali Yuga that we're in, we have other ideas, right? So and our memory is very short and we're not very intelligent. So it's written down. So you can just follow this and it works, right? So the idea here is this second chapter. We're hearing that, let's see. Just a couple of verses I'll just read just to get an idea of where we are context-wise. This is text 6. The supreme occupation, Dharma, for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendental Lord. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. Right? That's the point. That's what we're trying to do here. Text 11 says, learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. Right? So we want to approach the supreme. That's the supreme duty of man. And we have three levels or three qualities of that, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Brahman being based on knowledge that everything is connected, it's all one. Right, there's a connection between it. We're all part of the same universal substance, so to speak. In material illusion, we think that we're different from the world, and we're in control of the world, but actually we're part of it, and there are certain rules that we have to follow in order to make things work. Now, the Paramatma aspect is, why is it so? Right, or how is it so, you could say, where you understand not just on a knowledge level but also on an activity level that you have to act on it, you have to actually carry it out. And then the Bhagavan level, you have why the motivation behind it is this, is the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. The Supreme is actually a person, and there's a reason why the whole thing is manifest, is to have fun. Right, the Krishna is described as Atma Rama. He's self-satisfied. We don't have to, like when we offer our foodstuffs and we do the morning program and all, Krishna doesn't need that to be happy, but he likes it because it's more fun than just sitting there being self-satisfied. You know, all the expressions come through energy, come through activity. So you have the what, the how, and the why. It's also described as the jnana, the kriya, and the icha shakti of the Lord. Jnana meaning knowledge, meaning the Brahman aspect. The kriya meaning the creative element, the paramatma of actually acting on it. And then the icha, desire. And if we notice, it's actually upside down from what we usually look at when we're doing our sadhana bhakti. Usually, we here it says in the verse, with sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work karma. We try to mitigate our desires, right? We try to get rid of our false ego, and we try to do that with knowledge. So knowledge is the highest. You have the false ego is the ignorance, right? Which is the lowest. It's the desires, right? That's the lowest in material consciousness. Then you have all the activities that bind you, the passion in the middle, and then the highest is the goodness, which is knowledge. But from a transcendental point of view, it's the upside down. Because when you reach onto the spiritual level, then knowledge is just the basis, that you have knowledge of the Supreme. That's the liberation. It's said here that liberation is a nice side benefit. How is it said? It's a byproduct of devotional service. It's not something special. We sometimes hear of or think of moksha or liberation as something very special because we're suffering, basically. I was just speaking with Prayojana Prabhu before, and we came to the conclusion, basically, we're all suffering. You know, We're not in such like a gloomy kind of way, but there's always something. There's always a pebble in the shoe or something. And when everything seems all right, that's when you should really start worrying, right? So, but the liberation is just a byproduct. We don't have to focus on that. That's just the basis on which we perform our activities. And then the activities that we perform are what drives us forward. But actually, if you want to do devotional service, it's the icha. It's the desire. It's actually, but it's the desire of the Lord, not the desire of ourselves. Does that make sense? So it's like looking at a lake. You have a tree on the other side of the lake. The real tree is, but the reflection, the illusion of the tree in the lake is upside down. Now what you have to do is, if you want to go from the illusory tree to the real tree, you have to lift, you have to elevate your vision, right? It's not that you start going the other way when you hit the bank. No, you just continue in the same way. It's just that it seems what we're doing seems counterintuitive because we're in a material state of consciousness. So this thing of letting go of the ego, it seems uncomfortable because nobody else is looking out for me, so I'm looking out for number one. But actually, we switch cause and effect. So the reason nobody's looking out for us is because we're looking out for ourselves. Does that make sense? So we're also discussing how everyone's busy talking. Like it's described also here in this canto a little bit earlier that everyone is engaged in questions and answers, right? The birds in the morning, tweet, tweet, questions and answers. In the evening again, tweet, tweet. And so today, very popular on the internet is Twitter. Tweet, 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 tweet. We're all tweeting, you know. And so that's just what we do, questions and answers, you know. But the question is, what's the quality of it, right? What's the quality of our questions? What's the quality of the answers we get back? There's a relationship between that. And since we're being bombarded with all these impressions from the outside world about what we should be thinking, what we should be, I mean, most importantly, buying to be happy, we all have this need to be heard ourselves, right? So we talk a lot. Now, actually, if we want to be heard, fun thing is we should actually listen. Just listen. That's actually how you get people's attention. So that's what we're talking about, devotional service. We're talking about the desire of the Lord. What's the desire of the Lord? The desire of the Lord is to get the living entities engaged in devotional service. So if we want to be a part of that, actually what we should be doing is predominantly listening rather than speaking. It's because we can say so many things, but are people actually listening and are they taking it on board? Now, if we start listening, then at some point they'll want to hear what we have to say because that's special. It doesn't help to say that we're special because we're following Prabhupada or because Krishna says so or start quoting Bhagavad Gita, because for someone who doesn't know Bhagavad Gita, who doesn't accept Bhagavad Gita as scripture, that's not an argument. It's like Christians saying, well, it says so in the Bible. You don't convince anyone by that. You convince people by exemplary behavior. When they feel, you don't have to explain, by the way, I'm exemplary now. I'm following Dharma. No, you don't. They will notice it. If you're not pushy, they will want to know what is it that makes you like that? What do you have, right? So that's how we do it. That's actually what happens when we cut through the binding knots of reactionary work by remembering the personality of God. It is actually letting go because we're still on the material side. So we'll start by letting go of our own desires to for name, fame, adoration, and so on. And that is noticed by people. People actually do notice that if you're not pushing yourself on people. They actually feel attracted, right? That's the nature is if you push yourself on people, they draw back. But if you don't, they want to know, why are you so calm? Why are you so relaxed? That's not normal. You know, I've been traveling around, some of you may know this, Ask a Monk sign, and I was basically just sitting on the street with a little sign saying Ask a Monk any topic, and a lot of people came to me and asked me, how do you do it? what's your technique? And I was wondering, that was the only time I didn't know what to say, really, because people generally don't come and ask about the Chaturvyuha or, you know, philosophical questions. That's not what you're not. You don't need a lot of philosophical knowledge to sit there on the street. You just have to care. You just have to actually want to know what it is people have to say. And everyone in the world, without exception, I've come to realize, has a best-selling novel inside them. You know, the stories people have are amazing. All you have to do is care and just listen. How do you do it? But I'm not doing anything. I'm just sitting. But everyone's walking around looking for something. That was the difference. I was not looking for something. I was not trying to convince anyone. And that was attractive. Right? So I didn't actually realize that. And at first, it was just someone came up with the idea. I thought it would be a fun thing to do. And I did it. And so someone asked me, what's your technique? I realized it's not a technique. That's the problem. If you think it's a technique, that means you don't care. That means you're trying to figure it out. You're trying to manipulate. Oh, if I say this, if I do this, what's your mantra? That is not actually letting go of the false ego. You're still looking for that desire. So let go of that and just let people come and talk. Somehow I always knew what to say. I don't know. I mean, and most of the times I wasn't saying anything. And it's an amazing thing, right? So that's the non-sectarian thing when Prabhupada say we're non-sectarian. It's actually, we're all the same. That's the Brahman realization. We're all the same. It's not like, you know, in one sense you can say there are devotees and there's demons, there's, you know, those who are following, those who are not following. But how much are we actually following, you know? And how much are other people following? You know, other people are also following. Like if you take a street gang, they have a lot of respect for authority. Sometimes much more than we do. Someone authoritative comes and tells us something, it's like, what does he know? You know, but they don't work like that because they're out there. It's a rough life. You have to accept authority. They know it's a difficult life. We sometimes forget because, you know, it's cheese on toast in an hour. That's pretty cool. Right? So we engage in the spiritual process, and some of our, while we do that, technically, we are liberated. Like it says, it's a byproduct of devotional service. So while we're doing our morning japa, we are liberated. And then, of course, when we're done with our japa, then maybe the liberation kind of goes down a little bit. But the point being that the frustration with material life ceases. And so we start getting comfortable. Like in a street gang, you know this is not a comfortable world. You know, so you have respect for authority. There's some element of piety there. So the circles overlap. If you want to preach to a guy like that, you just talk about authority, how there has to be structure, otherwise nothing works, right? I was looking around the internet recently, just doing some research, and I stumbled upon this guy who made the Church of Satan. Wow, you know, that's pretty impious, you could say. So I was reading about him, and he had these 11 rules of the earth. And I'm reading through it, and it's pretty much dharma. You know, it's just, you know, you shouldn't kill animals, and then, of course, unless they attack or for food. We could agree with most of it, the last part, for food. We're not really so, I mean, technically in the Vedic scriptures, there is guidelines for how you prepare meat for food. It's just a huge, elaborate tantric kind of ritual that just means it's not worth it. So we can actually fit it in. What I mean is we don't actually have to disagree with him. We just have to say, okay, you do this. We do practically the same except for this little detail, you know. We change that. So another one was, you should not hurt children. Yeah, good. You know, you shouldn't be lustful for another man's wife. It's basically the Ten Commandments, you know. But then it's just tainted with this kind of little bit of ignorance there. You know, if you're walking in open land, bother no one. If someone bothers you, tell them to stop. If they don't, destroy them. Okay, a little bit of a heavy reaction there. But most of it we actually agree with. Why? Because dharma is not a dogma. Dharma is just the nature of things, right? That's just how it is. It's how we are. False ego, our attachments, our tamasic tendencies mean that it gets distorted a little bit. So that's why suddenly it comes up as the satanic something, you know, or or extreme liberalism where you have like 50 plus genders or something like that. And you kind of wonder, are they trying to be normal or are they trying to be unique? It doesn't really make sense. But on one hand, their whole message is, no, we're all normal. But at the same time, it's all so unique. So you can talk about that, but do it in a way that is all inclusive. Like, we include everybody. We're not a sect. We're not a cult. The problem comes if we think that here, this is like basically the spiritual world. Outside, that's Maya. That's Maya. Thinking like that is Maya, right? Because it's all the energies of the Lord, and the ability to see the devotee in everyone is equivalent with our realization, right? That's what the Uttama Adhikari, the Maha Bhagavat, the pure devotee is able to do, is to see the devotion in everybody and to see these universal principles working in everybody, right? So we were talking in the car about this preaching thing. How do we communicate with people? It's by finding their values. We all have values. We all have ways that we expect the good life to come about, right? That's, where was it? Anyways, I was reading that this devotional service is the only way to actually satisfy the self. So we have to look at, that's what everyone's looking for, how to be happy, right? So we have to find their values and then connect that with Krishna. You see, Prabhupada, Devamrita Swami recently, I heard a class by him. He was saying that how Mukunda Swami had said that Prabhupada was expert at small talk. Right, that he was talking about his loft programs. He has this successful loft preaching program. He's very good at reaching out to Westerners. And Mukunda Goswami has said to him, you know what you're doing is not new. That was actually what Prabhupada was doing in the 60s. Because a lot of these art types, bohemian types, beatniks, they were actually living in lofts and they would do programs at their place. It was cool to have the Swami come by. And he would, you know, come and prasadam was there and they would talk. And he would just small talk with them. So how's work going? And, you know, oh, so you're doing, oh, you're a painter, whatever. You know, and okay, so there, that's where the value is. And then whenever the opening comes, he's listening. He's not preaching, you're going to be an animal in your next life. That's not what he's saying, right? I've heard that's actually a real example for someone who came for the first time to the Sunday feast and a devotee is telling him, you know, you're going to be an animal in your next life. It's like, okay, bye-bye. You know, but Prabhupada, he's going into their world and talking about their work and small talk. And then when the opening comes, when they feel like, wow, this guy actually really cares about me, that's when the opening comes and that's when he connects that value to Krishna. Suddenly, you have the utsaha, you have the enthusiasm, you have the icha shakti, the desire shakti has been aligned with Krishna's desire. And suddenly they have an enthusiasm for devotional service. Because they're the ones who are going to get up early in the morning. They are the ones who are going to stop eating meat. They are the ones who are going to chant their rounds. We're not going to do that for them. They have to do it themselves. They're not going to do it unless they're enthusiastic. Because changing your lifestyle is hard. You know, in the 60s, we say, oh, these hippies, they were the lowest of the low. But let's be honest. They had lived with mom and dad until they were 18. Pretty pious life, you know. They hadn't been out drinking. Today, young people go out drinking at 12. So when we scrape them up at 22, they have 10 years of wild self-destructive behavior. So we're not going to just change that overnight unless we develop that enthusiasm. That's what preaching is, not telling people what's what. Preaching is making them enthusiastic. And by our behavior, showing them that, wow, this guy's got something, or this lady or whatever, you know, that there's something about this person that's interesting. That was what Prabhupada did, right? So we're not going to do it by management or big haveli coming up. There's nothing wrong with that per se, but if we think that's going to make the difference, or knowledge, you know, reading a lot of scriptures, quoting Bhagavad Gita, that is something we can use to support. But the highest, the Icha Shakti, that Bhagavan level, is the desire. If we can awaken that desire in people to try something new and to try and change the lifestyle, then we get them, right? So that's a very It's a very delicate thing, but it's actually very easy. I mean, we can talk for, we can do a whole week seminar on the techniques or what, but that's not what does it. It's our desire to know about them, right? That our ability to see that we are all one, we're all the same, you know, species. We're all devotees. We just have different levels of realizing it. And therefore, we have more or less confused ideas about how we will become happy. But we are actually all the same. We're all unique, but we're all the same. That's the thing where Vedanta is on a different level, is that, you know, you have politically, you have the liberals and the conservatives. Are we all the same or are we all different? Right? That's where it fluctuates. But no, we're both. We're the same and we're different. On principle, we're the same, but in expression, we're different. So that's the masculine and the feminine principle. Masculine, all the same. You see, men, they find one thing they're good at, they can just do it for the rest of their life. Doesn't matter if anyone notices or anything. We just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. That's why we're good at working, right? So women, you need variety, uniqueness, flavor, colors. You know, you ask a man how many colors are there? 6. Red, yellow, orange, purple. You know, you ask a woman, unlimited, like eggshell, bone white, sawdust, you know, it's like you keep going. It's like a man is like, what? So the variety in the feminine is the expression. So you combine that and then you have the jiva, right? Otherwise, you get one or the other and you fluctuate between them because they don't actually, they're out of balance. Both of them are out of balance on their own. But you get them working together, then you have something. So you can only do that by understanding that there's a difference between the soul and the body, right? Because the fact is, we're not all equal, right? On a bodily level, we're not. Some are intelligent, some are dumber than a bag of hammers, some are tall, short, some have, you know, born with weird diseases, you know, it's not equal. But everyone has this idea that we should be equal. So what is that? That's the spirit, that's the soul. Everybody can understand that. You know, I've spoken with literally thousands of people. Nobody disagrees with this point. So if you talk to people about, is there a soul, it's just because of confusion. You explain it like this, everybody accepts it. Right? So that's our purpose, is to bring people to this basic point where the knowledge is there, but take it further to this Icha Shakti where the motivation comes to actually act on it properly. Because, you know, otherwise, and sometimes we're not even there ourselves, otherwise it just becomes karma mimamsa. You know, you have the 6 systems of Vedic philosophy, you have logic, you have atomic theory, you have Sankhya, you have the yoga system. Then you have, these are all kind of incomplete. You could say there are verses in the scriptures that they just don't deal with because it conflicts with the system. And then you have karma mimamsa. Karma mimamsa can deal with all the Vedic scriptures. The only problem is the Icha Shakti is not there. So what does that mean? It means that karma mimamsa, I mean, it's the idea that everything, including the Lord, is under the modes. That actually, if I do good work, if I'm pious, I will get the result. Krishna has to give it to me. I am the doer. That's the final thing. The tiny, tiny speck of false ego that starts the whole material party is not understood. That if I do pious work, I will get good results. And to a big extent, it's true. You can see that. Indian people, Jai Shishi Radha Gokula Nanda Ki, Shita Ram Lakshman Hanumana Ki, Gaur Nitaya Ki. You can see in America, I was looking at average income. You see by cultural background. Indians are the only ones who are on average 6 figures, $102,000 a year or something. And the number 2 is like 83,000, I forget. It was also some Asians, right? And then they come 83, 81, 79 down, and then at the bottom you have people from other parts of the world, right? But there's a giant leap from one to two, from the Indians to number two. There's a giant leap of $20,000. That's the annual income for some people in just that leap. There's that gap between number one and two. Why is that? Because they're pious by nature. You know, they don't go clubbing. They don't buy a car that's more expensive than what they can. Some of you may have been to the United States. Walmart, have you been there? Or far out people there, if you're from Europe, they buy ice cream by the gallon, not the liter. I mean, they're not messing around. I went to Walmart in Houston on my way to the temple. I had to get in there and just check it out. I accidentally bought 1 kilo of M&Ms. I couldn't stop it. It was just, you know, I had to get something, and that's the sizes they buy. That's not pious. That's not self-controlled. That's weird. But it gets normal. If you're around it all the time, that's just normal, right? So I traveled around with this kilo of M&Ms for a month. I was looking, what am I doing with this? But the Indians don't do that. They come generally from a pious background, get up early in the morning, they have nice family relationships, they have planned marriages, not a lot of sex going on before the marriages, so you don't have a lot of unwanted progeny. All these disturbing elements of intoxication and frivolous sex, and the Indian community generally don't get involved in that so much. It's just a fact, right? And you just notice of these cultural backgrounds, Indians are, I mean, by a wide margin number one in average income, right? So you can see that the karma is working, but it's not good enough. Because what's the point? If you don't deal with that final false ego of the Icha Shakti, of curbing your desires to be in line with the desires of Krishna, it's still false ego. It's nice false ego, you know. It's usually when you say, you know, money's not going to make you happy. Sometimes the response is, well, I'd rather cry in a Mercedes than on a bicycle. Okay, but we're talking about the prospect of not crying. We're not talking about crying in this or that environment. And that's the thing with the Karma Mimamsa. It doesn't take care of what's called the Karana Sharir, right? You have the Stula Sharir, you have the Linga Sharir, and the Karana Sharir. Stula Sharir is this gross material body made of ignorance. Linga Sharir is the mind, the intelligence, and the false ego, the subtle body. And then you have the Karana Sharir. Karana means cause, like Karana Dakshaya Vishnu. And that is the original polluted consciousness of I am here to enjoy. The world is here for me. I will enjoy this. That is what we need to take care of. And it's very difficult to take care of if you are actually enjoying yourself. If you're on top of society, you don't have any debts, your daughters are both well-behaved and don't wear too short skirts, and your wife is dealing with you nicely and everything's cool at work, right? You don't really have a great desire to get out of here. That we see in some of the Westerners that we attract is quite the opposite. You know, we're sometimes we get a lot of people who have, let's say, a lot of baggage, right? They're not exactly per se pious, but they're very motivated to get out of this place. I count myself among them, by the way, because they know that this is not a nice place, right? So you have to combine that. You can only do that by devotional service. So that's the real knowledge. Knowledge is not knowledge of facts. Like a fun fact here, Chindanti, it says cut this knot. What was the verse? With sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work by remembering the personality of Godhead. Not by great knowledge of scripture, but by remembering the personality of Godhead. So Chindanti actually... if you look at the word science, etymologically, is a difficult word. The history of that word actually leads back to China. It comes from scientia in Latin and schizo in Greek. We can have a lot of fun with that one. But if we trace it back further, it comes from China, from Sanskrit, cut. So what science actually means is to cut yourself away from the material energy. And the fun part is that Today, science has become the opposite, is to engage with the material energy with your senses and try to work around it so you can. So actually, in that sense, science means cut off from reality, like schizo. You know, you have schizotypal or schizophrenic disorders, means you're cut off from reality. That's actually what it means, if you take the history of the word. So that's the problem when you're looking at from the wrong side, from the reflection, is that things are upside down. What you think will get you out is actually what's getting you in. You get distracted by the circumstances, by the energy that surrounds you, and you think that, well, if I deal properly with this, that's the karma mimamsa element, I will be happy. Actually, that is what binds you. So that's arguably a little bit of a problem here, because we have nice facility. Like, again, in some of the other temples, it's like barely scraping by, and they know that they have to really fight. But here it's kind of comfortable, you know. So that's a difficult thing, you know. We might be thinking that we're doing good, but maybe we're not. Maybe we're just getting comfortable. I'm not saying, but I'm just saying this is the risk that we're running when the karma becomes good, right? That's what happens. So Krishna, fast forward 9 cantos, actually uses this very nicely in the 10th canto, where in the Govardhan Leela, where excuse me. Where Nanda Maharaj is saying that we make this offering to Indra, you know, because he's giving the rain and we're living off the land, and so, you know, we offer thanks for him for managing so the whole thing goes by. And Krishna, he goes into karma mimamsa philosophy. What he's saying is, no, not really. Actually, we're all born out of karma, and you can't change your karma. Your karma is your karma. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And if you just do good work, he has to deliver the rain. He doesn't do anything. It's just karma. And so you might as well offer the puja to Govardhan Hill, right? Because that's actually what's delivered. It's actually coming from there. It's just mechanics anyway, right? So you might as well change it. And of course, Krishna always has a plan. So he's using the karma mimamsa philosophy to actually establish that's not good enough. That's not actually an explanation. He's establishing Vedanta through karma mimamsa philosophy. Does that make sense? So that was returning to this guy with the satanic rules of conduct. That's what we do. We just use his philosophy to establish Vedanta. If we just go along with it and say, we shouldn't, let's take that one. We shouldn't hurt animals. And then it comes, except if they're attacking us or for food, right? So the only one we actually have a problem with is the for food part. So we go into it and say, you shouldn't attack animals. Okay, that makes sense. You shouldn't be violent to animals, right? We can agree on that. Okay, we can agree on that. Good. So how far can we take that? Let's say we stop eating them. Would that help in the process of not hurting animals? Do we actually need? You say we can for food. Okay, let's say we can, but do we have to? So we use his own philosophy to establish Vedanta, actually. This is just a preliminary. Vegetarianism is not really establishing the highest Vedanta, but it's a preliminary to actually. And that's what Krishna does in the 10th canto. He uses this karma mimamsa to establish Vedanta. So we never disagree with anyone. We don't have to, because everything is contained within Vedanta. Everything about how things work is in this Bhagavatam. So we just have to find where it fits. And that's why we have to keep reading. Keep reading, keep reading, keep reading. Prabhupada said you read the books, then you study the books. Then you go systematically through the books and find out what does it say, where does it say it, and how does it connect to my life, right? So we have to become better at that. Otherwise, we're not. The problem is, if we say we're not sectarian, but everyone else is, that is about the most sectarian thing you can say, right? So the way to not be sectarian is to be able to take whatever people say and see how does it connect. Small talk with them, you know, and just when the opening is there, then connect it to Vedanta. Does that make sense? Then the enthusiasm comes, and they find, oh, wow, this actually applies to me. Chanakya Pandit has four elements of learning. There are four stages. First you listen, then you contemplate, then you apply, and then you can teach. Right? So you listen. It doesn't mean just hearing stuff, because our memory is bad. It means, you know, we call it active listening. It means you have to care about what's being said. You have to care about it. If you're motivated, you care about it. If you understand, if you have faith that this is going to help, then you'll actually listen. You'll try and remember what's being said. I was doing a seminar on masculine feminine principles, or a trial run of a seminar meant for non-devotees. And this guy came up afterwards and said, "This is the most amazing thing I've ever heard." And so I asked him, "Okay, what part did you specifically like?" He couldn't remember anything I'd said. He just remembered it was really great, but he couldn't actually say back to me anything that I'd said. It was like literally 30 seconds after it stopped. And he was still excited. He couldn't remember anything. And so you have to listen, you have to remember it. What is it? I mean, take notes, but not too many, because when you're writing, you're not listening. So try to find a few points and, okay, I'm going to remember these. Then contemplate. What does that mean? It means think about how does that apply to my life, because we're all the same, but we're also unique in our circumstances. So I'm speaking to everybody right now. So if there's something you like, how does it apply to my life? What in my situation, how do I use this? And then apply. You have to actually apply it. Otherwise, nothing's going to happen, except you're going to forget it again, right? And that's where it sometimes is difficult with ISKCON. I was traveling around a lot, and I found there was a pattern. Everywhere I went, it was always the same questions. And I came back year after year, it was still the same questions, and I would give the same answers, and there's still the same doubts, and then the same people got fried out, and I'd come back a year after, it was exactly the same. Right? So place to place, it was different issues, depending on the circumstance, but it never changed. That's why I've settled in one place now, because I was thinking, this is not working, you know, I'm wasting my time here. Because you have to work, but we can do a lot ourselves if we notice. Okay, listen, contemplate. Don't speculate. Contemplate. You know, how does it apply to my life? And then actually apply it. Then you see, does it actually work, or should I adjust something? And when it works, then you can start applying it to others. Meaning teach, right? That you can present it in such a way that it works with other people's conditioning, not just your own. But the problem we have is we skip the two middle parts. We hear something, and then we start teaching it to others without actually having applied it ourselves. That's when it becomes hollow. That's when people feel violated is a strong word, but sometimes we come off in a kind of chopping way, like, you know, the chopping technique, and I use technique lightly. That word, you know, technique. Usually, we don't have so much technique, we just chop away. And if you imagine someone is at their home and someone shows up with an axe ready to chop, it's likely, I mean, figuratively speaking, it's likely that you won't let them in. So they chop the door down and they start chopping into the hallway, and they start chopping the door in there, and you're like, what's happening here? You go into the living room, start chopping the furniture, and then you're in the kitchen and you start chopping the pots. They're made of metal, so that doesn't work. But the countertop, that's wood, so you chop a little at the countertop. You know, people are going to, what the hell, you know? So we can't, that's not the process. Chopping technique is in very, very special circumstances. And it has to be done with a lot of knowledge. That what actually works is caring. Actually caring. Seeing that there is a devotee in the person and caring, being a friend. So we have to look at seniority and authority. I've been told I can go a little over time because it's cheese on toast day, and they're usually late with the cheese on toast. So just stop me if you're tired. Yeah? Okay. I won't be long. Where was I? Chopping technique. Caring. Yes. So we have to make friends with people. When we meet them, we have to make friends, and we can do that. If we just listen to them, because nobody's listening. You know, nobody listens to each other. You know, you see people talking and suddenly one of them just picks up the phone and starts texting. And it's like, it's just normal. It's not like nobody actually complains about that. It's just normal today, you know. It's not that we're rude. It's just that modern society is geared to make the mind flicker even more than it does on its own, right? So many impressions, so many, everything is internet, you know. That means everything is just a click away. It means you can also leave somewhere just by a click. So, like, reading a book is like, what the hell, you know? There's not even, the pages are not even moving, you know? You can't even click around on it. It's just what it is, right? So it's a very difficult thing to slow down. But when people meet someone who has that ability to just stop and just listen to whatever they have to say, that's amazing. It's not that what they say usually is of any significance. You know, it's just they have to say something. So they talk, and then at some point they start asking about you because you're not trying to push yourself on them. That means that utsaha comes, that desire to actually learn about the other person. Then suddenly the false ego is gone. That's actually service, right? So you have devotional service. Service is one thing. It has to be active. You have to apply. You have to be active. You have to be out there. And devotion is the mood of not being selfish about it, not looking at book scores, not looking at them as fallen or something. Because we can't see the sad fact is we've grown smaller for 3 decades now. That's just a fact, right? So we have to change that. Right now we're living off rich Hindu money, and in 20 years these guys have left their bodies. So the question is, will their sons be as generous? Likely not. So what do we do then? Are we looking at a partial collapse of ISKCON? You know, I'm just throwing it out there. I'm not being political. I'm good. But I'm just saying we've actually forgotten how to preach. And if we're afraid of the outside world, if it's all Maya out there, we will not be successful. If we, on the other hand, have faith that we have the supreme philosophy, there's nothing to be afraid of. We just take whatever they say, connect it to Vedanta. Vedanta will be stronger. You know, that's why the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita is, now you got the knowledge, now do whatever you want. It doesn't say you have to do this because I say so, I'm Krishna, and this is Bhagavad Gita's revealed scripture, so you have to follow. It says do whatever you want. Now you know, so do whatever you want. So that should be our attitude, because they have to, whoever it is we're talking with, have to develop the desire themselves. It doesn't come from knowledge. In 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that's the last thing. If you can't do anything, develop knowledge. That's the last thing, you know. It's the foundation, but it's not necessary. What we need is faith and enthusiasm. The knowledge will come. Krishna will give it to us. That's the fun part. I was sitting on the street, and people would ask me all sorts of questions. Sometimes they would ask me trick questions that I wasn't supposed to know, just to see how I would react. Somehow I always had an answer. I don't know where it came from. Sometimes I was thinking by myself while I was talking, wow, this is pretty good, actually. You know, because it doesn't come from me. I'm not the doer. Krishna is. So you have to take chances. You have to do that. One of the regular questions from devotees is, how do I experience Krishna in my life? You have to do something you're not qualified to do. Don't be stupid. That's not doing something ignorantly, but doing something that's beyond your actual qualification. If you do your absolute level best, Krishna will do the rest. You know, he will preserve what you have and carry what you lack. And as we surrender, he reciprocates. Not as we submit. That's another thing we kind of get wrong sometimes in ISKCON. We confuse surrender with submission. That's not. Surrender means surrendering the idea that it's all for me. Submission means just do what I say. Right, because I'm senior. So we neglect to see the difference between seniority and authority. Authority means you have a relationship. If you're living in the temple president or the temple commander or Sankirtan leader is your authority. That means he can tell you what to do. But if you're on the street and someone is, you know, you're approaching someone, you're not an authority. You may, in a sense, be a senior person because you have more realization, but you can't actually tell people what to do. It's not your place. And if you've been around longer than someone, but you don't really have a relationship with them, you are not an authority. You're a senior, and the other devotee is supposed to be nice to you, but you can't actually go over and tell them what to do. That's not your place. Because you get all these senior devotees with various ways to conduct devotional service, coming to the new bhakta and telling them all sorts of things of what to do, and lo and behold, a month later, he's not there. Surprise, right? So we have to distinguish between these things. And how do we do it? Well, the easy thing is to just develop that utsaha, that enthusiasm ourselves, because then we will by nature be friendly. All of this only becomes complicated when we don't have that initial desire. When we have the initial desire, it becomes very easy. You see the gopis, they're not philosophers. They're not quoting. I mean, they can, if it's the lila, if it fits into the lila, they can do all of these things. But what's driving it is this Ichha Shakti. It's this complete, absolute desire for the Lord's pleasure. And that means they can manifest everything. They use philosophy actually to tease each other rather than to try and liberate each other and bring them closer to Krishna. They use philosophy to go away from Krishna because the desire is so strong that just makes it all more interesting, right? So if we can actually develop that desire, it becomes very easy. So, Hare Krishna, thank you for tolerating me. And any questions?